Welcome. It's my honor and pleasure to moderate this panel today. My name is Robert Farris. I'm the research director at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. We have a fabulous panel of really smart, experienced, clued-in people here. They happen to be friends and colleagues as well, so I'm a little bit biased, but anyway, they really know their stuff. To my immediate right is Nagla Risk. She's a professor at the American University in Cairo, and she is also the founder, I'm not going to get the name of your institution wrong, of where are you, Nagla? You are the Access to Knowledge for Development Center. I know it is A2K for D, yeah. And that's why I can't read out the whole thing. Okay. To her right is Dalia Othman. Dalia is a fellow at the Berkman Center for the past 2 years. She's also a research
visiting scholar.
A visiting scholar at the Center for Civic Media at MIT. To her right is Nadine Weheba. Did I say that right? And I don't even know your title. She works at the American University of Cairo as well, and she's the Grand Puba. What's your title there?
A researcher,
yeah. Yeah, fabulous. Lina Atala is a journalist who right now is the chief editor for the Mata Masr in Cairo. It's a web-based newspaper. She's also a researcher at the center in Cairo. And at the far right is Faris Mabrouk. Faris is he's the director of the Arab Policy Institute. He's also leads the UNIS Social Business Global Acceleration Program. The collection of us, along with a few other people here, have been engaged in a project to try to understand how the network public sphere works in the Arab region. We borrow this term, the network public sphere, from Yochai Benkler, who describes the network public sphere as an alternative avenue for media, a place which kind of gets around the traditional gatekeepers, which is less under the control of government, which provides an alternative for setting the agenda and the framing and for highlighting given topics and articles of public interest. And so the general question on our mind here is, how has this worked in the Arab region, and using analytical and research tools at our disposal to do so? So these days we have a lot more data, we have a lot more tools in which to study the network public sphere, which is wonderful. We're still learning as we go. We'll show you some of these tools and techniques today, but we're going to focus more on some of the big picture items today as well. We've gone through, I think, several waves of optimism and pessimism about digital tools in the hands of civil agents. I think before we knew anything about it, there was a lot of optimism about what they would be able to do. Another wave of pessimism came through. In the wake of the uprisings in the Arab region several years ago, we saw, again, another wave of optimism coming through, because this was, I think, much real, stronger evidence that in the hands of the right people, these could have a real effect on social and political processes. I think that optimism has also been tempered over the last couple of years. So these are some of the things that we're going to talk about today. So what we're going to do is do a couple rounds through the panel, take your questions following that, and hopefully have a nice dialogue around these issues. And what I'd love to do is start with you, Dalia. Dalia has been spending a lot of the past 2 years looking at the Arab blogosphere and Twitter in a few countries as well. And I guess we're going to start with the question of, what's our general understanding of the network public sphere, and how has it evolved over the last couple of years?
Yeah, sure. So I wanted to I wanted to sort of focus mainly now on the Arab blogosphere. And what you're seeing right now is a map of the blogosphere from 2014. It's a snapshot in time. And it's something, I guess, we've built on. Back in 2009, the Berkman Center did a study on the Arab blogosphere. And there were very interesting findings that came out of that, namely that the blogosphere was used for a way to comment. It was a way for people to comment on certain things, be it political, be it social, cultural, or even religious. And so we decided post-revolutions that we would take another sort of snapshot and look at this blogosphere again. And I'm going to keep it short and sweet and say, like, one main finding in this was the fact that the Arab blogosphere is actually in decline. There aren't a lot of blogs out there anymore. And what blogs that you see, there are quite a few of them that are online, but they're people aren't actively blogging. So they're available online, you could see them, but you see that they've stopped blogging. And there are certain, you know, some of the bloggers have chosen to explain why they've stopped blogging. They give they sort of write up their last blog, and others just quit blogging. And what's interesting is that we see that a lot in the political blogs, especially in Egypt. And what we see now is that people have refrained from blogging, but sort of reflect their political ideology through the banners they use. So you see a lot of bloggers from the Muslim Brotherhood who would put up banners that would indicate that they're sort of supportive of or bloggers for the Muslim Brotherhood. And on the other hand, you see Egyptians on the left who have their own separate banners as well. And so we're seeing that inactivity. Saudi Arabia, for example, and I think this is a key issue, in the 2009 blogosphere, Saudi Arabia was the second largest sort of group or cluster of blogs. Right now in the 2014, it's almost disappeared. And, you know, we say this in keeping in mind that a lot of sort of Saudi Arabia is the largest population in the Arab world that is actually active on Twitter. And so we can sort of discern that bloggers are slowly moving and shifting towards social media.
So. Super. Thanks, Dalia. So a couple things we need to come back to later. So one is the nature of pan-Arabic discussion here, and the shifting platforms is clearly a big issue here. Yeah. So, Lena, you've been a intimate observer of this. You've been reporting on it and living it for several years now. I wonder if you could give us your perspectives as well, please.
Okay, so I'm going to start with a quote from one of our interviews in Cairo. And it says, can you hear me? Okay. I feel the microphone is a bit far. So the quote reads, since some time we have been used to a certain level of tolerance and acceptance because we all look alike and we are all from one generation. Yes, there are differences, but not so stark like when we take it to the streets. When we are talking on social media, we are happy, but if we say the same things on the street, we get beaten up. We had this confined place that now turned against us. This is the end of the quote. And this is an excerpt from one of our interviews with an interlocutor as part of our research looking into the developments and the evolutions and the changing functions of Egypt's networked public sphere. This person is a veteran blogger. He had a blog, one of those blogs that would probably be a dot in this map. He is also an active, he has been an active social media user, and his words resonated with those of others reflecting on how social media became less of an alternative home throughout the last 2 years in Egypt. In descriptions of digitally mediated public spheres, the notion of an improved network architecture is brought on with the facilitation of access to expression and reduced hierarchies and more horizontal modes of production, rendering political engagement more possible. While this possibility unfolded in several Arab contexts, it was also quickly connected to the Arab Spring mobilizations, and much of the attention shifted from the depiction of these constructed public spheres to how these public spheres should be conducive to some kind of a mobilization. The last 2 years, however, gave us an interesting possibility to better examine these publics outside the scope of mobilization without casting the burden of mobilization on them, mainly because there haven't been so much mobilization in terms of state protests and so on in the last 2 years. Instead, it became a possibility to understand the formations of these publics and the extent of their influence. For many of the conversations we had, parallels could be drawn to Benedict Anderson's imagined communities, whereby societies are formed not around face-to-face interactions, but through the imagination of individuals of being part of a community. This imagination is possible thanks to the access to the print industry, says Anderson, which helped disseminate material and content that led to the unfolding of shared values. The internet's imagined community has not only given access to a shared discourse, but it's actually actively engaged in constructing that shared discourse. The similar sense of an imagined community has unfolded online in ways where active users expressed belonging to a certain intangible group that is not a political party or that is not a labor union. In this space, personal identification with surrounding events and their emotional register is key in shaping the community. I'm going to quote also another of our interlocutors, a famous programmer and activist who currently happens to be facing a prison sentence on charges of protests. And he says in describing this community, on Twitter, you are not really using it to talk to a public. You are using it to talk mostly to people who would be directly involved in your popular committee, your work, or your refugee work, for instance. They may be your colleagues in the same thing or just from a network that could be sympathetic to the same cause. When you share the personal stuff, you are also talking to that same network or some subset of it. I think there's a lot of value when we start looking at emotional reasons and benefits from doing that. Even when you start sharing this, maybe with your family or within your work colleagues or whatever, it wouldn't have the same emotional register. And so we need this thing in order to find the same people who would have the same level of anxiety, depression, or happiness around certain events. These events shake our world, but at the same time, the rest of the world doesn't actually treat them as such important events. And this is the end of the quote. Now, while for Anderson, the nation is one such socially constructed and imagined community, this very nation started joining the digital platforms and shattering the sense of belonging that the early adopters had, as well as the sense of imagining it as a special community. Online spaces became less sites of imagining the nations or alternative nations and became more grounds of reasserting tangible realities and the state-mediated version of the nation. A growing sense of nationalism engineered by the state through the machinations of populism has been omnipresent online. This has come on the heels of a major regime change in Egypt, whereby the country's military institution came to replace an earlier Islamist regime. And while mass media played a major role in mediating this renewed sense of nationalism, online platforms became a more available space to a wider group of users to express it, share it, and defend it. It was also a space where traditional powerhouses, namely the state, but also powerful political groups and individuals and figures consolidated their presence. As such, and to end, looking into the changes that occurred over the public sphere in the last two years in Egypt, and in the digitally mediated one in particular, it is important to separate between two things. On one hand, there is the function of online platforms to the formation of political communities that can speak to the failing of the traditional political organizations, and this is something that should not be forgotten the wake of talk about failures and successes, and the wake of talking about failure of online spaces for mobilizing change. While these practices online don't have to be necessarily geared towards major political change or on-the-ground action, they are important. They have been important spaces for conversation, discourse formation, and alternative political imagination. On the other hand, the expansion of digital spaces to become a bigger and larger host for the different publics of the nation lends itself to a different set of realities. While online spaces introduce different languages, ideas, as well as modes of expression and conversation to the public sphere, the advent of a more offline presence to online spheres reversed this dynamic. And as we see more alignment between the offline world and the online worlds today, a set of questions start rising, such as what are the new modes of production of nationalism engineered through a digitally mediated network public sphere? How do the online spaces mediate the nation to a larger network public sphere? And what are the roles of the traditional powerhouses like the state in there? And finally, can there be still spaces reserved for communities of dissent with some level of audibility as part of a truly networked public sphere, or are they doomed to be diluted? And is this inevitable because of the growing volume of the network and the weakness of its interconnections? I'll leave it to my other colleagues to, you know, try to hit these questions, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Lena. There's a lot of great stuff there that I think we have time to pick up on later. Nagla, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Thank you, Rob. Let me just take it from Lena. Lena spoke to us, gave us the image, the picture of what truly happened in the decade of the 2000 to up to the uprisings of 2011 and then afterwards. What we see today is actually summarized by one of our interviewees who said in very simple language, the ground has come online. It's a very different world. That the public sphere, the network public sphere right now, is a platform where you have the different groups. They're joined, the early pioneers are joined by practically everybody. So the idea of this space being sort of democratizing and providing opportunity for everybody has indeed been materialized to the point where not only do we have the pioneers, the activists, but we also have hierarchies that now come in line and side by side by the achieve hierarchies. Examples of the interviewee that Lena talks about are people who achieve their status by their own achievements online through what they said and spoke and through their blogs. These are people who achieve their status and their own hierarchies. Now we have the state, the media, top-down hierarchies that came side by side by these pioneers, and actually summarized also by this by the interviewee telling us a whole new country has joined us. The people we argue with at home, our family and friends, are now present to argue with us on social media. We are unable to change the way we speak to these new entrants online, just like we have had our failings offline and our disillusionment online, offline. So that's the fragmentation that has taken place by everybody joining in. This is a huge space where messages are diluted of the original pioneers, where messages cross, where actually a great deal of polarization takes place. And again, this is only reflective of the polarization that we see around us on the ground. So I refer to Yochai Benkler's in describing the network public sphere as expressed in his book, basically we had what he calls the Babel objection, the idea of the fragmentation. We do actually see around us a lot of that. In fact, we also see too much chaos and too much centralization. We have the two trends side by side, just like I look at it as, you know, when you have centrifugal forces away from the center, giving forces to the small players, and at the same time, the opposite currents are taking place. You have the centripetal forces, vertical hierarchies being established and very active online, as Lena has alluded to. It is the kind of polarization that is at the level of the state. So it is something to deal with and to start and to realize and to actually start to see where this can lead us. And the sad part is that the mass media is actually playing a role in the polarization. So you see this circular flow where certain groups are actually quoted in the mass media, but of course there is a selectivity that feeds into the polarization that is taking place. At the same time, I want to emphasize the relationship between these two worlds. When we talk of a networked public sphere in the Arab world, we take a step back and we look at the Arab public sphere. It is a representation of the public sphere that we have with all its uniqueness, with all its own path. Perhaps we need to step back and think again. The notion of the public sphere, as presented by Habermas, the idea of capitalism giving space to a democracy and political debates and eventually the role of the media, we've had a different model in the Arab world. We need to study that model, and we need to really see the perhaps the achievements and but also the failures that we have in the public sphere are also reflected in the network public sphere. So on a positive note, there is a role for looking at this from a different lens and from a different perspective and trying to see how we can use these technologies and devise new tools, perhaps novel tools, to study and assess what we see around us. Two of the points that I want to emphasize, may that be the polarization and the mirroring, or the extreme mirroring of the network public sphere to what is on the online spheres, to what is going on offline. We have seen this in our field work, and I know that Nadine will share with you pictures that show that. We have done all of our interviews, actually focus groups with the different groups, with the Islamists, with the regime, you know, the pro-military groups, with what we call the non-aligned group and, third way or non-aligned group. We have interviewed, different individuals from the Muslim Brotherhood. And basically what we see as, for example, the hierarchies in the Muslim Brotherhood as an institution, their approach in dealing with social media was similar to that. So you see the hierarchies that are on the ground are actually coming to social media with their own values and their own mechanisms, with their own dynamics. So may that be the state or mainstream media or institutions like the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's no longer the world where we had the activists, having space to interact and to impact a mobilization on the ground. I will stop there, and then I know that Nadine is going to follow up on that.
Good, good. Yeah, so I just want to highlight a couple things before I let Nadine take over. So one of the things I hear from you is the prior notion of the network public sphere creating its own new hierarchy is being challenged by prior hierarchies now asserting themselves online. Mm-hmm. Also a filling in of the network public sphere. Mm-hmm. Concerns over fragmentation, polarization. Got to come back to those for sure. Yeah. Nadine, please.
Okay. So what I wanted to show is a few illustrations of the points that Nagla was talking about and Lina on these the nature of the offline and online dynamics in Egypt and the importance of looking at the context in which all this is taking place. So these are images generated using a software called WebRadar, and this basically collects and analyzes data from Facebook, Twitter, and different news websites, and it's developed by a company called Innova in Tunisia. Yeah. So what we see here, this is a timeline of events on the Tamarot campaign. This was the campaign launched around April 2013 against the rule of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. What you see here is mentions on Facebook of the word Tamarot. And just to let you know, point B is when the campaign was launched on Facebook. And we don't really see a surge in the online conversation about the topic as a result of the creation of the Facebook page. Versus, for example, there's a very famous Facebook page in Egypt called We Are All Khaled Said, and this was created after the brutal murder of Khaled Said outside an internet cafe in Egypt by the police in 2010, and it's become synonymous with the uprising in Egypt. You don't see that effect with the Tamarot page. What you see instead is several peaks that take place after players from mainstream spheres, like on TV or political parties or political figures, endorsing the campaign. So just to give you an idea, for example, the first peak is when the April 6th activist youth group announced their support for the campaign. The second peak is after a combination of different political parties endorsing their support for the campaign in mass media and in the press. The third and fourth peak represent endorsements after the effect of endorsements from prominent political figures and presidential candidates. And the fifth is obviously the one at during the protests, the June 30 protests at the presidential palace in Egypt. And so what we can say here is that in terms of the relationship between the offline and online spheres, we do see that mainstream players are perhaps more powerful in driving the conversation online and do remain to be very influential in the case of Tamarut. And the next image kind of tries to illustrate what Nagla was talking about polarization. Let me tell you what this is. This illustrates, polarization specifically on Facebook. Facebook is very important in Egypt. This is a 16% penetration rate. We're talking about almost 14 million Facebook users. versus Twitter, where it's under 1% of the population. The period of time we're looking at here, or this is a snap, yani, from 30th of June 2013 to around the end of August, and this is the time when the military government overthrew the Islamist regime that was in power, the Muslim Brotherhood, and this was also during the forceful dispersal of the encampments at Rabaa al-Adawiyya and in Nahda squares, which were calling for the reinstatement of the deposed president. So what you can see here is posts shared on public Facebook pages. These circles represent the sources of these posts, so the different pages, and their size represents the amount of posting on by the source. The distance between the circles, is reflective of the extent to which they discuss common topics. And the circles that are linked are discussing common topics, and they have a similar stance towards that topic. So you see clearly on your right, I think it's your right, a cluster of Islamist-affiliated pages, whereas on your left, you see one of regime-affiliated pages, regime-supportive pages. And what we do notice is kind of an absence of pages that represent the views of the non-aligned group. This could either because they did actually say this in our fieldwork, that some of them chose to disengage at certain points, especially on Facebook. The point here is that the online sphere, at least at this point, was in fact mirroring this offline polarization of discourse in Egypt, and it is reflective of what Lina was saying, of a shift from more of a community of like-minded people to a whole country or a society coming online.
Super, thank you, Nadine. I think we were going to go
To
Dahlia. So we're going to have one more view. Hold on, we're going to Tunisia next, but we're going to have one more view of Egypt before we go there.
So I just want to build on everything that was said already. And I think when we were comparing notes about our research on the offline versus online and the Facebook versus Twitter, we were, I guess, maybe excited, maybe depressed, maybe, I don't know. But we realized that a lot of the results in some sense were validated through our combined research. And this is a map of a Twitter map of Egypt from 2014. Again, this is just a snapshot in time. But what is really significant about this map is that it's there are distinct, very distinct groups of clusters. And each circle is a handle, a Twitter handle. And what we saw is that the map itself was divided on based on two themes. One was political and one was apolitical, social, cultural, more of a personal thing that with basically users avoiding to talk about politics. But what was really, I think, very, very interesting is the distinct clusters or grouping of the political clusters. And so what you see, and I don't know if the colors are very clear, but the top, there's a green cluster, and those are people who align themselves with the military or support the military. At the bottom here, the yellow are people who align themselves with the Muslim Brotherhood. And what's interesting is that in the middle are the people that we're labeling or calling basically non-aligned, who support neither the military or the Muslim Brotherhood. And again, what's really interesting about this is the fact that they're very distinct groups. They're very divided. They're not. We don't see a lot of interlinking between them. And so that sort of emphasizes the whole issue or the whole question of polarization. We really see that on Twitter as well, even though it's a 1%. But but we do see that sort of reflection from the offline to the online.
Super. Thank you, Dahlia. Faris, let's hear about what you've learned in Tunisia.
First of all, I'm glad to be here. The subject is very important, especially with all the transition and the changes that we are now living and witnessing in our countries. Understanding the Arab network public sphere is also important to understand how to better understand individual behaviors, collective behaviors, and maybe understand the radicalization, polarization. The good thing with the networked our public sphere is that we have data. So once we have data, we can try to model, we can try to analyze. So let me share with you some of the ongoing research we are doing to better understand the typical period of time on the NPS, network public sphere. So typical, what would a typical week look like? So we had this approach saying that a typical week we would have like a production of information. So how many information are put in the system? How many publication? This is production. Then you have promotion. How many like? How many share? And then you have interaction. How many comment? People are commenting. So that's what this is the way to describe a typical week activity. So in a typical week in Tunisia, we would have have 62,000 new publication. This is an average of 62,000 publication, and each publication would have 20 likes, 10.7 shares, 4.4 comments, and it would reach 13,000 internet users. So this is a typical week, and this is a normal week, let's say. And then from there we try to see what happened in singular points. What is an abnormal week, and what explain this abnormality or this singularity? Interesting. So you have the data we just went through, and so you have the share, the comment, the like, and then you have peaks. And the interesting part is that the peaks we see on the online are exactly the ones which are related to some violent events, generally violent events on the street. So we went through these peaks and trying to understand what is the relation between the online and the offline. Is there a relation of, there is a correlation, but then we'll have to explain, is there a certain point, sort of causality. We introduced a level of violence in the publications. Okay? So we have 1% of the publication in average that contain a term, violence, bleshure, aggression, assassination, and so on. And the average number is 1%. But what we saw is that when the level of violence increase in the publication, the level of reach will the level of comments will change. So we have higher number of share, higher number of comments. This was just to share with you the way to modelize and to come with a model that would explain the collective behavior on the public sphere. And this is ongoing research. Hopefully we'll come with other results.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Faris. So we've had kind of a few different overview looks at the network public sphere. We've started to dig into the data a little bit. I want to start picking off a couple topics and start thinking of questions you want to ask if any of these are of particular interest. So one of the things that comes through from this is that the network public sphere is now reaching a broader cross-section of society. We want to figure out whether that's good or bad. Good, we hope. It's certainly a different world than when we looked at the blogosphere 5 years ago and saw, I think, what was at that time elite bloggers talking and debating in long form complex political ideas and building coalitions now. And what you've shown us here tonight is very, very different than that. So the polarization in Facebook that we see, the topical selection in Facebook in Tunisia, the polarization in the Twitter networks there. Should we pause on this notion of polarization and ask about this? Is this an inevitability as the network public sphere becomes a better reflection of society at large? Is the network public sphere just a reflection, really, in becoming a better reflection of life underlying it. There used to be the sense that we would kind of create this alternative layer that would somehow be better at debate and deliberation and perhaps would help with these very complex collective decision problems and governance there. Is there a glimmer of hope left for that now, or are we just going to go back and say it's business as usual and people are just taking their problems and their biases and their prejudices online and that's all we get? Please do.
I'll give it a shot.
A little a breath of optimism, please.
Yes, yes, actually, yes, I will try. Well, I'll keep the optimism till the end, okay? I mean, one of the questions when we asked during the focus groups, you asked the group and you said, do you find the internet and the social media, is the internet democratizing? And somebody said, is it democratizing or dogmatizing, you know? And then... So on the one hand, it can help to exacerbate, you know, the differences and polarization and so on. But on a positive note, you think of it as, like democracy. When you open the door for every, you know, equality of opportunity and everybody comes in, you are bound to get results that you may not like very much, right? I mean, that's a price you pay by opening the door and bringing everybody in. Now, in a moment of flux like we are living in Egypt and in Tunisia, I'm sure, what you see on the ground is this polarization. This is, and that's, I go back to the idea of the public sphere. This is the public sphere that we have everywhere. You know, there is a sense of there are tensions, tremendous tensions sometimes in the same family. So like you have the, you know, the tensions online and the fights that you have sometimes on the network, you also, it's also reflective of what is happening on the ground. So we would like to think that this is a period of transition where, you know, we are learning, just like, you know, our research, as researchers, we are learning. I think as a people, we are learning. We are learning, hopefully, to, you know, to debate better, to accept the other better. I mean, a moment of modesty is in order. We have to learn to be tolerant and accepting. So, I mean, these are my two cents. I don't know if they're positive, but, yeah.
Thank you. Please.
Yeah, I do believe the same in Tunisia. I mean, the network public sphere is the mirror of what's happening on the ground. But it's like, you know, the sort of mirror that exaggerating the default that when you look to yourself, I think it accentuating the polarization, the all what's happening on the public sphere. This is one. Two. The problem we have is the lack of media. In the survey we organized in Tunisia, reason number one, people go online on Facebook to get the news. In a situation where there is a lack of credible media, Facebook became and has a completely different role, I guess, from the role it has in other countries. So this created also a new role and a new completely new structure.
But in Tunisia, it's been a positive role from your perspective, the addition of alternative media sources.
I mean, it played a role in the transition, in the beginning, I mean, in the revolution, yes. Then we are still lacking real media. Facebook is killing the media, I mean, the traditional media business model, because all the advertising is going to Facebook or in Google, or all the traffic is going to Facebook and Google. So there is no chance today for traditional media to emerge. It's very difficult for traditional media to emerge in Tunisia. And I do believe that traditional journalists, media are very essential for country to move forward. And I don't see this happening in Tunisia due, in part, I don't know what you think, Lynn, about this, but it's more you.
I don't know if you had a question about media that can be saved for later, but...
Let's stay on media while we're talking about it. So is the network public sphere working in a sense in the way we hoped it would in... highlighting through a meritocratic process better sources of information? Are people finding alternatives and views, and is that being highlighted in a way that it would not be were it not for these digital tools?
Yeah, if I might reflect on this a bit, I think as a few of us have highlighted, the traditional powerhouses on the ground have also managed to learn so much how to navigate online spaces and to create also spaces of power for themselves in these spheres, and hence they've become dominant players in the network public sphere. So mainstream media, mass media, the sense of Egypt, major television channels, major corporate media have become the most widely followed sources of information online as well as they are offline. So in a sense, this is a shift from from the infancy stage of online spaces, where the volume of presence there was much smaller, but at the same time there was much more influence by smaller players. So definitely there is an issue. I share also Ferris's concerns of online media, and not online media, but social media in particular, Facebook in particular, also not always playing a very positive role for the highlighting of smaller media practices, mainly due to, it's the advertisement model, mainly due to, the selectivity in which posts are streamlined in people's streams. So there is definitely a growing bias against alternative sources of media nowadays.
A note to that. I think that's. I think what you said is very important in the sense of navigating these platforms. And it seems like a lot of the sort of governments or people, like the hierarchy, has been established because they've been able to navigate those platforms. And I think we need to take a step back and look at how these platforms were built, what algorithms they use, how these feeds were promoted or certain posts are promoted. And I think that loops back into the sort of reflection, the offline and the online. I think for activists, there needs to be some certain form of awareness of what these platforms can do and cannot do and how to navigate them. And maybe possibly part of that reason is because we are using platforms that were not built for social mobilization. They were built as social networks, and there are certain specific algorithms that are tied to that. And so that could drive the question of are we going to stick to Facebook and Twitter, or what's next?
Sure. You want to stay on this? I love this topic. Please do. Yeah.
If I may, I just have a quick follow-up on this. I think one of the questions that I was telling my colleagues that I went back to reading Yochai Benkler, and one of the questions that he raises in his book is the internet too chaotic, too centralized, or neither to promote democracy? And his answer is that it's neither. It's not too chaotic. It's not too centralized to promote a democratic discourse. Now, looking at Egypt around me, I'm just wondering, I think it is too chaotic and it is too centralized, and I'm not sure that combination as it exists in Egypt is enough or is good enough to promote a democratic discourse. Precisely because of what you said, because of the high media concentration, because the content that is included by virtue of the ownership of this of these media platforms, by their allegiance to the state, by the selectivity of how they use the content on the internet, that it can become a very dangerous tool and also emphasized and distorted and exaggerated because of that mirror. So this is a time, perhaps again, to rethink these questions. And does that answer hold today? I think we need to think a bit more to answer that question in view of what we look around us.
So I want to hear more about this. This is fascinating, and I kind of want to merge the two of these things, which is how much of that is a function and is it related to the choice of platforms? So we've seen the shift from more open media in the blogosphere to a lot of the network public sphere residing on Twitter and on Facebook, which have their own architectures which tend to nudge behaviors in a given way, and that's kind of colliding with the underlying kind of perceptions and the opinions and the ideals. Do we blame this on Twitter and Facebook? Is there a better approach to this? How do we look at this? What are the kind of the affordances of these platforms that are helpful for debate and deliberation, and which aspects of these are detrimental? Are these just engines of chaos and centralization, as you call them? I'm not sure we know the answer to them, but they feel to me like very, very important questions to be asking.
Yeah, it's a difficult question.
Yeah. I might start reflecting on it with you guys. I think there was always a merit to the long post, which is the main content of the blogs. In the space of a long post, chances are you manage to make a fuller argument, and chances are you force the person who's reading to reflect more deeply in the space of this longer piece of content, as opposed to having to hastily react to a shorter post, be it on Facebook or Twitter. So definitely the form of the platform affects the types of ensuing conversations. The fact that, there has been a migration from, the blogosphere to spaces of Twitter and Facebook, whereby, we find much more shorter pieces of content here and there, is affecting the quality of the debate. That said, and I think this is something we referred to earlier today in our conversation, it's interesting how many people from the blogosphere world have brought the blogging tradition to Facebook by only engaging through, the writing of longer posts. And these tend to be, again, sites of more interesting conversations than the, shorter pieces of content. In fact, in my newspaper, we tend to look around for these, and when we find an interesting conversation happening in the aftermath of a long post, we actually contact the author and, ask them to develop a piece of an op-ed based on this Facebook post. So that's...
Yeah, one major change I see happening now, in especially in Facebook and Twitter in the Arab world, is the security of. During a certain period of time in 2010, during the evolution, Facebook were the most secure, safe place to take risk and publish. Why? Because of the community, because of the impact you had, and because the governments were not, comfortable with attacking someone for posting on Facebook. But today, even in Tunisia, where we're supposed to have democracy, people are also arrested, and there is a lack of clear reglementation. How do we manage? Is it the public? Is it the public sphere? Is it the private sphere? What is the other limit you can post on Facebook? So there is also a chance of this, and maybe the way, because it's no more the safe way to publish, it will probably change the type of content we have, and definitely the role of it.
I want to see if there's any questions from the audience. I have 20 more myself. We'll start here and then go to the back. Yeah.
I have a really simple question. It's an untutored. I work a lot on crisis mapping, and I'm thinking about platforms like Ushahidi. It's such a different, designed to be thin data, right? So I'm curious whether you've looked at that, those kinds of platforms, particularly the ones that are free. And I work on Syria, and I've seen some of the maps that are generated through them, and I think there's real methodological problems, but I can imagine that there might be interesting conversations that come out of using those platforms or... if in fact you're going for the ultra short post or the crowdsourcing or this kind of, I'm wondering, as people who've thought more deeply about what you guys think about, I'm curious if you've thrown that into the mix or if that's just sort of analytically a different project. That's a big question.
I'll take a whack at that while you guys are thinking. So that's a really good question. I'm sure there's a lot of valuable stuff to learn there. There's, of course, a profusion of platforms to look at, and we haven't gotten there yet. It's a very interesting question, which is, if you want to understand what's going on online in civil discourse, what do you study? And in the Middle East, the answer right now is Twitter and Facebook. That's where you go. That's where a large majority of the ideas are. And the question that we don't fully know the answer to, is that really a good reflection of the totality of views that are taking place underneath? My guess is it's pretty close, but I'm not sure. Are you following up on that, or are you going to a new question? I'll come back to you. I promised the gentleman in the back.
I'm following up on it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I'm following up on your point and directly to your point as well. On my way over here today, I had the benefit of spending some time with a retired Marine who now works for Fidelity Investments in the enterprise architecture department, and he does nothing but platforms. And you made the assertion that people are being arrested for making posts on Facebook. So I'm wondering, you know, we had some measure of success with Voice of America Radio and its heyday, and I'm wondering, is there not some platform or group or organization that can develop a totally encrypted, nameless, faceless, traceless voice of freedom for all members on the planet to be able to feel free to speak the truth?
Great question. Who wants to feel that? Me again? No, I'm not answering all. I'm the moderator.
I think there are platforms that do offer that, where you're completely anonymous in, or your data is, I would say, maybe 90% anonymous. I'm blanking on names. I know we've like talked about them in the Berkman community, and there are platforms. The question is, I think, sort of to build on what you're saying, is if you have a completely you have to consider security as one aspect of a platform, but then you have to think about the community element, or having the ability to communicate ideas and information, having some form a trusted source, and being able to organize. And I think being completely anonymous might create an obstacle for that. So,
but it's better than being arrested and tortured.
Yes, but there's a sort of you get to do a cost benefit, or sort of balance, like weighed out basically, and see, you know, security versus versus complete impact. And I mean, I don't know what the answer to that would be. Of maybe there's a platform that would combine both, or doing some more offline social mobilization. I mean, I'm also
ask the Marine to look into and see if you can develop.
I'm going to add on this. I have to jump in. So there are ways to maintain anonymity online. None of them are 100%, but some of them are 99%. And if you really want to speak anonymously online and have the knowledge and the technical chops, you can do it. It's hard to do that and also join a community of people and have a real impact in the world. And most people interested in civil rights know that. And for that reason, you see people taking a lot of calculated risks by speaking out in their own voice with their own face. And that's the decisions that they make. It's a hard decision. I'm not sure I would make the same decision, but it's a decision that people make. If you want to be on Twitter and be anonymous and you live in Tunisia, you can do it. If you want to be on Facebook and be anonymous and you live in Tunisia, you can get away with it as long as no one flags your account as being under someone else's name and take you down. But there are avenues in which to do that. My last thought on that is that getting ideas out there is actually pretty easy and very hard to block ideas. The things that have a real impact on the world is the creation of networks and communities. And doing that anonymously is really, really hard. And there aren't many examples of it. The group Anonymous, I think, is the one exception out there.
Can you block the geo-position tracking tool?
I don't know. That's beyond my technical know-how. Somebody might be able to flag that one. Yeah.
You can opt not to geotag, though I think it can be inferred from
So on Twitter and that kind of thing, you can opt out of that, certainly. So if you're on a Western platform, if you're on Facebook and Twitter and are diligent about maintaining security, the only way that a government could get access to your information is if Twitter or Facebook turn it over. And they don't do that routinely. But nonetheless, people still use, well, depends on the, I shouldn't speak to that. It depends on the rationale for it. They put up a fight often. If there's a good legal rationale for turning the data over, they do it, and that's the standard by that. Some people disagree on whether they should be pushing back more than they do, but they have pushed back in many cases more than they have to. You had a question.
Yeah, well, I was just, so there's some research just coming out recently about how few people understand the algorithm, or that there is an algorithm curating their Facebook feed. And I think Twitter has been experimenting with, a little bit with what they do, but mostly Twitter has been a platform where you just get this continuous stream, and there isn't kind of just however many people you subscribe to, however many times they post, you're going to see that. So it's a fundamentally different model for distributing content. And I'm wondering if any of you who've spanned both networks, rather than looking at them in isolation, if at all you've tried to compare, how well the content reflects the what you believe to be the ground truth as a result.
So you're asking whether they believe that the algorithm is filtering what you see in these places in a meaningful way.
Well, it's certainly filtering it, right? And I'm just wondering if you've actually observed meaningful differences as a result of one platform doing heavy-duty filtering that people aren't even necessarily aware of, whereas the other isn't.
I'm trying to think. I mean, I don't know if that answers your question, but there have been a number of cases where activists have maybe used Twitter instead of Facebook to get their message across because of this issue. So they were able to fully understand, or I don't want to say fully understand, to have some form of understanding of how the hashtag sort of how to create a trending hashtag works. And so they were able to sort of work within that algorithm to highlight certain trending hashtags. I know this definitely happened with the Palestinian prisoners' hunger strike. They had a very specific set of sort of steps that they would take so that the hashtag would become a trending one. And so I think there is some awareness, but with I'm not entirely sure about Facebook. And I think but you did say something about public posting, public versus private, and so there is some understanding, and I'm going to let you talk more about that.
So there was an example out of the United States, and maybe this is at the base of your question, and after the Ferguson protests, there were people noticing that their Twitter feed was full of information about the protests in Ferguson, and that on Facebook there was next to nothing about it. Do you see similar things in the Arab world?
I think the fact that even though Twitter has very little penetration in the Arab world, and Nadine had the numbers, I think, or Nagla, I don't remember. Yeah, so even though Twitter has far less penetration than Facebook, it has always been treated by people who feel like they are here to broadcast a message. It has been used more often than Facebook because there is this feel that nothing will be censored. It will just, everything will flow, everything. And there's a better sense of archive. There's a better sense of traceability in Twitter, in people's mind, than in Facebook. And that's not judging from any data. That's judging from, observation and personal practice. Personal practice as, as an activist, but also as someone who's running a newspaper and who has to navigate, the posting of content between both these media. Again, with, this very small percentage of Twitter penetration in Egypt, it might not make sense to invest in it. But again, the fact that there is a better sense of traceability of this content on Twitter makes us still want to stay active on Twitter and not just, restrain ourselves to Facebook. So.
Yeah, I also see this happening for the media, for the traditional media. I know that Facebook has a function. When you create a page, Facebook page, as a media, as a traditional media, if you have this page validated by Facebook, then it will appear. I mean, it will increase the number of time it will appear in timeline. So it will increase the number of likers and followers and so on. So this is maybe a way for Facebook to give more credibility to the content you have. At least I saw it in Tunisia. I know that the two or three media that had increased the number of followers had their pages validated, and this validation is proof of credibility. At least this is a very positive way to credibilize.
No, I just had a quick follow-up, actually anecdotal evidence on the use of Twitter versus Facebook, building on what Nina says. It was very prominent, even despite the low percentage of users, it was very prominent in delivering a message during full mobilization during the uprisings. But one of the things that we found also from fieldwork on the ground are quotes by, you know, non-aligned group or activists who said, in the beginning, we used to put out a tweet and it would mobilize people to go out on the streets, you know, in large numbers. Now, with the public sphere, with the internet being so populated and so busy, with everyone being online, that message is diluted and that impact is not felt by the activists anymore. In fact, one of the activists put his status on Facebook, which was very interesting, because he said Twitter now feels like you've gone to you enter your own home and you find other people living in it and pretend that they know you. And then, you know, they're using your stuff. And it was very funny. And he says, if you agree, retweet, I mean like. You know, he's on Facebook. So just these things give you a sense of I go back to my earlier point about, you know, and also what Lina mentioned about this, you know, the pioneers who played a role in sending out messages through the platforms are sort of taking a different stance, taking a stance that is a slower and more calmer stance than being out there believing that their message will be delivered towards mobilization.
Can I stay in this area for a while? So one of the aspirations of this research was to try to better understand kind of the reflection and connectivity between the online and offline world. We used to, a long time ago, have debates about blogs versus journalists, and that's long gone, finally. We still talk in terms of online and offline, and I think that distinction is softening over time. Particularly as more people get online and just people's lives are both, and to make that distinction for most of us really isn't that relevant anymore. But penetration in Egypt is now almost 60% yeah. Internet penetration, yeah. Facebook much less, Twitter 1%, is that what you said? Yeah, so there is perhaps a meaningful distinction there. I don't know if you know the numbers for Tunisia. They're probably a little bit higher, but not that different, yeah. What did you learn from your interviews with people about kind of this intersection, the connection between online and offline worlds?
Well, certainly, it's not a binary anymore because the two worlds intersect. It's about the dynamics between the two worlds, and they feed into each other. There was actually a tweet early on during the uprisings and says that usually we learn that if you tweet a piece of news, you have to put a link to a media source, a mainstream media source. But now mainstream media are quoting us because we are taking pictures on the ground. So it's become full circle, you know. So the word that's happening on mainstream media or online or just in people's on the ground with families, they're so intersected. And again, the polarization, just like it's happening online, it's happening with disagreements within, you know, one's own family. These things are happening. There is no, it's a blur. It is just one word. And coming, I mean, the statement, the ground has come online is actually very indicative. We have anecdotal examples from, you know, and I know that we have from the, for example, Tamarrud interviewed one of the, you know, few members of the Tamarrud campaign that Nadine has shown, and we have found several pieces of evidence that, you know, the activities on the ground were actually what triggered action. So it's hard to divide, and the binary is no, I don't think the binary is valid anymore. The question is, how can we work with the dynamics between these worlds and how can we study what's happening in the network public sphere in a meaningful way to promote, you know, positive or optimistic results?
Any other thoughts on that?
What she said.
She said it very, very well. Yeah. Other questions from you guys? Yeah. Please over here, and then we'll come back there.
Is it feasible, given the political context in the countries, to make use of social media or social media platforms to have a kind of mediated conversation, facilitate conversation between the different points of view that are now populating the various platforms in countries? I know that Twitter does town halls and things like that, but has any consideration been given to that possibility?
I think you've stumped the panel. That's a very good question.
Do you want to chip in? We have an answer from Neva.
I think the way it is that if someone says something, like if you start a debate or if someone is, it usually ends up being rude or it crosses the line and you end up blocking that person or deleting that person. It's not really a room for communication. People want to say what they say, and a lot of people post comments or like statuses, and they say, if you disagree or if you have something rude to say, just refrain from commenting at all. So I think that has been my experience or what I've seen personally.
I wonder who would moderate. I can
maybe give a shot at that.
Sure.
Following up on Naram, we have to think that in this part of the world, we've had authoritarian regimes for a very long time, and before that we had colonialism. So we really have, we're learning, we have a lot to adjust and a lot to develop. So to say this positively, and that goes to perhaps the earlier point of the uniqueness of the Arab public sphere, the network as a reflection of what we have online. So we have a lot to learn. We are young, I'd like to think of us as young democracies, or on the way to being a young democracy. So we are learning as we go across. And I think that's part of the frustration and the failures. I mean, the frustration is for everyone. The frustration is for the non-aligned activist group. It's a moment where we have to be modest and we have to admit to our own failures, the ability to engage, the ability to build, a dialogue on the ground, offline, online. We're still working on that. So,
I agree with that. It's an unsolved problem, and it's not only a technical problem. It's a human problem. We're just not as good at open-minded debate and deliberation as we would like to be. And technology tools perhaps still help in some sense. I think strong moderation is a really good thing. It helps in any context, online, offline, even with mediocre moderation, you can get by sometimes. But anyway, lots of work to be done there. Yeah. Yeah. Please.
Hi. So you've made this point a couple of times that the Arab public sphere is different from the traditional Habermasian Western public sphere. I'm wondering if you can sort of detail what that means to you and if the other panelists agree with that notion. Sorry, there's a part B. Dalia, I think you mentioned that the Arab world uses sort of Western-centric platforms or platforms that are developed primarily originally for Western audiences, Facebook, Twitter. And I'm wondering sort of 10, 15 years down the road if you think the public sphere is going to still be concentrated on those platforms. Okay, yes.
No, I'm just okay.
Or if there are going to be, or globally, if there's going to be sort of more local nation state based or community local based platform.
Yeah. Well, this is a very sensitive topic, and I certainly have to tread this very carefully because I don't want to be understood the wrong way. I don't want to be in any way saying that we are not fit for democracy. I think the idea of what the Arab world experienced was at moments of openness and of if you will, intellectual, early in the 20th century, it was a moment where people who were, not revolution in the sense of going out in the street and protesting, but revolutionary thinkers had a common goal, to get rid of colonization. So it was a way, there was a consensus towards this, but I don't think we have had as a long pattern, as a catalog, if you will. The Habermasian catalog is a certain, you know, this happened, and then you reached a case where you have democracy, and then, the you know, with the internet, there's a network public sphere, and this is a natural growth of a democracy that developed throughout a certain period of history. We had a different path in the Arab world. We had colonization, and there, when there were debates and spaces, may that be the mosques or the cafes or, you know, the intellectuals, the goal was more or less common to get rid of the colonizer. But the sad news is that when we got rid of the colonizer, we had authoritarian regimes, and then sort of a setback. So we do not have long stretch of a natural birth, if you will, of democracy. We're struggling to get there. So we had, you know, some hurdles and hindrances, and we are getting there, but it's going to take some time. So in a way, we had, when the internet came and with, you know, the 2000, there was a big, there was big hope, and there was big space that was open for the young youth, you know, using the technologies. But then things did not develop as we would have liked. And what happens is that you have a populist, really what you have, we have populist politics, and we have activists facing, being threatened even in the psychological sense, not just from the regimes, but also from society. We're still developing that culture of debate. We will get there. I don't want to put the Arab public sphere in any negative light. That's not the intention. The intention is to just take a moment and really realize what are the strengths, where are we heading, and how can we get there? In using our own model, it will not be the, you know, following a catalog of what happened in the West, and that's no different than actually discourse in development, for example. And, you know, if you look at the development of how the path for developing countries, they will not follow the same path that took place in the West or in developed countries, but they will develop their own paths. And we look at, you know, the emerging economies, and we look at new models of development that are unique to their own spaces. So that's really what I hope that clarifies, you know, what I mentioned. Thanks.
To top that, I think it's also worth noting that sort of the adoption of technology and the evolution of that adoption has changed, has been different for the Arab world. And so looking at sort of pre-revolutions and who was actually using these platforms, the elite, and then sort of this sudden surge of people who started using all these different platforms. And I know that we've also been looking at sort of media as well and how media is covering certain topics through a different tool we use at Berkman, which is Media Cloud. And what one of the techniques that we use is sort of looking at the link economy of how sort of media sources link to each other. And what we're realizing slowly is, or what we're starting to realize, it's not a final sort of conclusion, but is that in the Arab world, there's not much of a link economy. So you don't see that sort of influence through and attention through the link economy. And that's a very, very different usage than the Western world. And so that's something worth digging into and trying to understand why that is the case. And to answer your question, or at least attempt to answer it, I wish I could really predict what's going to happen in the long term. And if anyone else has an answer, please jump in. I think there's an interesting rise of tech startups that are happening in the Middle East, and there are some platforms that are emerging from those startups. I think there is a future in that, but the question is whether those platforms are modeled after Western platforms or are more of a sort of original coming out of the culture, coming out of society platforms. I really can't predict what's going to happen in 10, 15 years. There might be a shift to those platforms. There might be sort of a burnout in the use of Facebook and Twitter, and we're certainly seeing more of that with a non-aligned activist sort of taking a step back and not being active on these platforms anymore. So I don't know if there is this one platform that will emerge from the Middle East, or it might emerge from the West and people will start adopting that. Technology as a whole is changing. We're seeing more wearable technology. We're seeing, you know, I can't predict. I wish I could. I'd make
a lot of money.
You would tell us. Good.
Yeah, I know. I'd make a lot of money.
Lina, you want to jump in?
If I might just have also a quick thought on this. I mean, I don't know what are like cultural intentionalities associated with the building of these platforms. But what I know is that, you know, again, the early adopters, when they got online, they managed to adapt these spaces to their needs, and you know, the way they use it, the way they domesticated these platforms, made their, you know, space of origins quite, you know, irrelevant, agnostic, right? It's really about, and you know, an example is, for example, this interviewee who was talking about how, you know, Twitter became the alternative space to the traditional leftist political organization on the ground in a typical Arab city, whereby, you know, there is much more attention to the individualities involved in the collective. There is much more attention to the emotional register. And these are things you don't find much in the traditional organization, political organization type. So in a sense, there was this process of adaptation that basically centers the agency on the users, on the way the users have socialized and you know, adapted these platforms. And I think that's very important. And to also add that there have been a few, actually, attempts to build platforms in the Arab world that would mimic what Twitter does, and would they would originate from the Arab world, such as Dakwak and a couple of other examples, but they failed tremendously. You know, they maybe tried to address certain things such as language issues, semantics, all these different things, but they didn't work. People remained on Twitter and, you know, continued to be very happy on Twitter for a long time up until the crowdedness happened. And, you know, we're having a different situation there. So I think it's important to, like, remember, and this is what I've been trying to get at, it's important to remember, even though there is a disillusionment from, you know, a network public sphere in the Arab world and in Egypt, we have to go back and remember that there was a successful production of discourse on these spaces by these early adopters that shouldn't be trashed completely. And their success lied in their ability to imagine something alternative or something different, as opposed to just representing what's happening on the ground as is. And I think that this is the missing link, that, you know, in fact, the online and the offline are too aligned, are too much mirroring each other, that there isn't like a space, an alternative space of imagination online somehow.
That's really interesting. I'm so tempted to end on that, but I will see if there's a final question, that, if anyone has one to add to that. Sarah, please. Thanks.
So I've been following the Western media, especially in Europe, about the Arab revolutions, and my observation was that the Arab world was sort of presented as this entity, like they didn't really make a difference between the Egyptian Twitter sphere, the Syrian blogosphere, the Tunisian online spaces. And there were headlines like Twitter revolution, Facebook revolution all the time. And my impression was that there was too much of this, oh, the Arab world is all the same and all the revolutions are all the same. And I also felt that the impact of social media was probably a little overrated. And I was wondering how you feel about that.
Thank you.
Well,
I mean, yes, I agree. I agree totally. And I think it is, I mean, we have to strike a balance and look at the positive impact that took place. There was a critical mass for sure that took place. It was a moment of change. But at the end of the day, it's the, you know, there was a critical mass, but it's the masses that made the difference and they made the movement. So on the one hand, we don't want to, on the one hand, we need to emphasize the role that was played, for sure. There was a role, especially in the context that we talked about, you know, historical context and the space that was open. And actually, all the more reason to give credit to the early adopters, because these are the ones, you know, through the online forums, through the blogs, these are the ones who built the platform for that sort of thing. And then Facebook and Twitter followed. But I totally agree. I think it was exaggerated. I think there was a hype around Facebook. Certainly, you know, the Facebook revolution, Twitter revolution, and all of that, I think it's overrated. still we need to make sure that we acknowledge the role and study it and look at how this role was played alongside with the dynamics of what was happening on the ground as well. So these are my two cents.
I see nodding heads across the board. It's 6:30, so I think we're going to end here. The conversation will definitely continue. There's a myriad of very, very interesting questions that have been put on the table here. So you folks are going to be very, very busy for a while, and there's a lot of data to dig in as well. Last piece is to thank you all for joining us here today and sharing your insights.
Thank you very much. Thank you.